part is if we're able to help.
I used to be.
Okay.
Deficit?
House Committee on Revenue for February 24th, 2009 will come to order. The first item on our agenda today is an information meeting on the corporate minimum tax reform. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're following up on the discussion from a week ago Friday about the different tax bases, and there was a lot of questions around kind of how overall tax policy and overall state and local fiscal policy fits in with business location decisions. So we've put together another panel for you to continue that discussion. Unfortunately, one of our panel members had a root canal yesterday afternoon, so we had asked Commissioner Tom Bryan to come down from Washington County, so that seemed like a valid excuse. So, but we do have Joe Courtright here, and Joe is chair of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. He has an economic consulting firm and also formerly an employee of the Legislative Assembly.
Wonderful. Great to see you this morning.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, and I wouldn't trade places with Commissioner Bryan for although some people regard a trip to the legislature as
a root canal.
Only slightly less unpleasant than a root canal, perhaps. But it's actually a pleasure to be back here, and as Paul mentioned, I did serve as a staff member to the legislature for about a dozen years in the 1980s and 1990s. So the set of questions that you've posed today about the connection
And may I ask you to identify yourself for the record?
Certainly, of course. For the record, Joe Courtright. I'm an economist with Impresa and am chair of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, although I'm testifying in a personal capacity and not on behalf of the governor.
Thank you. I'm not sure why we do that, but even after an introduction, we still need your identification. Thank you.
Certainly. Basically, what I'd like to do is just give you some thoughts about this issue of the relationship of taxes and the state's tax structure to the development of the economy over time. This has certainly been one of the most perennial issues to come before the legislature, to come before this committee, to come before people in economic development. And I think there is a very kind of durable set of myths that are out there that influence the way people think about that. And the first thing I'd suggest is you might want to think about reframing the question just a little bit to get this in the correct context. I don't think it's really a question of whether taxes influence economic growth or industrial location. I think the real question you want to ask yourself is, what are the set of policies that the state puts in place that influence its long-term economic growth? And what are the things that happen in the state? What are the characteristics of our state that influence our opportunity to grow and have prosperity over time? And clearly, taxes is one part of that framework. But if you just focus on the tax piece, I think you maybe magnify it out of proportion. I think it's also interesting that when you first of all, that's the first and most important thing to do is think about this in the broader context. And I'll try and inject what some of the other policy issues are in a moment. The second thing I think to be aware of is when you look at state and local government finance across the United States, there's actually relatively little variation among state and local governments in how much of private sector economic activity they tax. When you look at the numbers, say, for example, from the Tax Foundation, which are based on census data, they show that most states take between about 9 and 11% of total personal income in the form of taxes. Now, they all do it in slightly different ways. We know Oregon relies more on the income tax. Other states rely more on consumption taxes, sales taxes in particular. But in almost every state, between about 9 and 11% of total personal income gets taxed by state and local governments and used for a pretty similar set of things from state to state. Now, we all do it in a little bit different ways, but that's not a huge variation in economic activity. And surprising, when you look at where Oregon ranks in that measure, we rank pretty much right in the middle of the pack right now. We have been higher historically. In the 1970s, we were in the top 10 in terms of the share of personal income that went to state and local taxes. Now we're about 25th, according to the latest numbers. So when you look at the aggregate level of taxes that are revenues, private sector income that's being taken in by state and local governments and spent, we're pretty much in the middle of the pack. Now, the other thing that I would say about this is that, I think there tends to be a naive belief that if we somehow just lowered the amount of revenue that the public sector took out of the private sector, that would stimulate the economy. If you lowered the aggregate level of taxes, and I don't think there's actually terribly good evidence for that. When you look at the relationship over time, and there are a number of studies that have looked at this, how much state and local tax levels influence levels of economic growth, of personal income, there aren't really strong correlations over time. So, to the extent that there are relationships, some studies will show that a small increase in tax rates or the amount of money that the state and local governments take from the private sector has a negative influence on economic growth. But in almost all cases, that's equally offset by the benefit of public spending. When you take money from the private sector and you spend it on education and on public services, that makes your state a more attractive, gives your state a stronger economy, and can, in some cases, depending on how you spend it, make your state more attractive. So if you look at just taxes in isolation and don't talk about the package of public services that you're using to purchase with those taxes, then you miss their economic impact. The other thing that I would stress is that while we can talk about, and I so far have just talked about the aggregate level of taxes, oftentimes there's a lot of debate about exactly how you structure your tax code and what choices you make about which businesses you tax. And it's really interesting that when you do very detailed comparisons of state tax systems, some states tax business more than other states in the aggregate. But it's interesting that because businesses are so different, they have different structures of sales, they have different profitability, they have different asset bases, that no matter what tax system you implement, it will affect different businesses very differently. And the state of Washington did an interesting study several years ago that constructed a series of business models, and they took businesses in different industries like forest products, in aerospace, in software, in retailing, and so on, and different sizes of businesses, and they computed what these model businesses' taxes would be in different states. And they found there's no consistent pattern. Some states would tax some businesses a lot, and other states would tax those same businesses a little. So they're just, I guess the key point about any kind of tax system that you would put out there is it wouldn't have a consistent impact on all businesses. No matter what system that you put in place, it'll produce relatively higher taxes for some businesses and relatively lower taxes for others. So the notion that you get one system that is equally good or is better for business than another system is kind of an impossible dream because there is so much variation across different businesses. The other thing I would say about thinking about the way tax levels influence the economy is I think there's a fixation, particularly in the economic development world, on companies that are seeking new locations and how important that is to the growth of your economy over time. If you look really at the growth of economies, it's really driven by the creation of new businesses in your state, by entrepreneurship in your state, and the growth of those businesses that are started here as they expand over time. The relocation of businesses from one state to another state is actually a very small fraction of economic growth. The latest statistics I've seen show that over a three-year period, about 0.3% of all U.S. businesses made an interstate move. And that counts businesses that moved within a single metropolitan area. So somebody who moved from Multnomah County to Clark County would be counted as an interstate move. And that's actually fairly common across the United States. if you look at sort of the happy hunting ground of the economic development community, everybody has been going to Silicon Valley for decades to the San Jose area and trying to recruit high-tech businesses from what is arguably the highest cost business environment in the United States. You know, California has all three major taxes, property, sales, income. It has a very expensive housing cost. If you can move businesses based on the cost of doing businesses, on the cost of doing business, San Jose and Silicon Valley ought to be the easiest place to get people to move from because it is the most expensive place to do business. Over a 10-year period, according to one study, fewer than 3% of all of Silicon Valley's high-tech establishments moved outside the region. And of those, fewer than a third left the state of California. So, you know, we have this idealized view that there are businesses that are driven by cost, and many have to consider cost in their location. But it's actually a relatively small percentage of folks. So in terms of just general advice that I would give you for thinking about how to structure the tax system to optimize economic development, first of all, I'd say you want to think about staying in that band, that 9 to 11% of personal income band. And Oregon is pretty much squarely right in the middle of that band in terms of overall tax burden. We do not have an extraordinarily burdensome tax system. That said, I think you want to have a close look at what I would call sharp edges. There can be features of your tax system that have negative implications for particular kinds of businesses that may be important to your state. And from time to time, those issues arise. And we had one such issue, I think, arguably about 15 years ago when we put in place the strategic investment program for the high-tech industry. We had a situation where Oregon's reliance on property taxes made it relatively uncompetitive for very large-scale capital investments on the order of several hundred million dollar investments. And we made a very targeted change to the system that essentially filed down that sharp edge on our tax system. Interestingly, probably an even more important and less noticed change was the way that we treated depreciation of capital equipment at the state level. Because, you know, if you apply the same schedule to manufacturing equipment, say to a paper mill, which has a 40-year lifetime, to a wafer fabrication facility that has a five-year lifetime, you get very, very different treatment of that capital and of the income from it. So you want to be aware of those sharp edges. But a system that's clear, that's predictable, and that, is again, stays within that band, I think, is probably the most important thing. And then finally, I'll add, as I mentioned at the outset, the bundle of public services that you provide for business is critically important. Now, what I do in my consulting practice is I advise state and local governments about how to develop regional economies. And we know with a certainty the single factor that is the most important factor to the long-term growth of regional economies in the United States. And that's the education level of the population. We can predict with about we can explain statistically about two-thirds of the variation in state per capita income just by knowing the educational attainment of the population. So the investments that you make in education and the educational attainment of Oregonians is actually, in the long run, the single most important factor in explaining the health of the economy. And we hear that from businesses, too. We spend a lot of time talking to businesses about what does guide their location decision. And for nearly all the businesses that we deal with, the most important factor that they look at is how well-trained is the local and well-educated is the local labor force. Does a community have a robust supply of talented workers, and is it an attractive community in which it is relatively easy to recruit more talented workers? And I won't spend a lot of time talking about this, but we are on the cusp of a very dramatic change in U.S. labor markets. It's sort of masked by the recession that we're in right now. I look at around, and I see a lot of fellow baby boomers here. Some of you are not all baby boomers, but some of us are here. And once their 401ks recover a bit, but we know inexorably baby boomers will retire, and they will leave the labor force. And as they do, we are headed for a period of fairly dramatic labor shortage in the United States. So places that have lots of talented workers and to which it is relatively easy to attract more are the ones that will be best positioned for economic growth in the future. So by all means, you know, pay attention to business and think about the tax system, but also think about the set of investments that we make, particularly in our what economists call human capital, because we know going forward that that'll be really the pivotal factor that shapes economic growth going forward. I don't know if that's enough content for a whole panel, but that's probably about all I have to contribute, Mr. Chairman.
Well, yes, Representative Bailey.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, didn't mean to cut
you. No, that's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious just to prod a little bit further on this education idea. Are those statistics broken out at all by education that is developed within the state or education that is attracted from outside the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, the numbers that I gave you are just the educational attainment in aggregate of the population. So the key number we look at, and you can use, there are a variety of indices that you can use, but it's the fraction of the adult population with a four-year degree. And in Oregon's case, we have been the beneficiary of a substantial in-migration of talented people from other states. So to answer your question directly, it's both the people we educate here and then also the net migration of talented people from other places.
Yes, please.
And clearly it goes without saying that it's important that we invest in raising the talent level of Oregonians. In addition to that, are there factors that that determine whether or not people who are educated from other areas will move into a particular area?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bailey, yes, absolutely there are. And we've done, my firm and a national organization we work with called CEOs for Cities has done a series of studies looking at the migration of college-educated 25 to 34-year-olds across the United States, a series of studies we call Young and Restless. We know that a 25-year-old with a college degree is the most mobile person in the United States, most likely to move across state lines. And to answer your question directly, there are a specific set of factors that we know these mobile, talented young workers are looking for, and it has a lot to do with quality of life. They're looking for communities, and particularly urban communities, that offer a good quality of life in a variety of ways. Part of it has to do with urban form. They're looking for dense urban neighborhoods that are walkable, bikeable, that have diverse consumption opportunities. And they're looking for places that have good public services, including public schools. And the other thing I would say is, within that group, the different places offer different bundles of public services to people. So the folks who come to Oregon, and Oregon is a big net beneficiary in terms of this migration pattern, but we get a different set of people than other places. We get a different set of people, obviously, than, say, Atlanta, Georgia, which is another place that gets a lot of talented young people. So every place has its own distinctive niche.
Thank you. I heard you mention in there good public schools. Are there differences in what attracts high quality workers from other places and what keeps them here? Are there initial variables that bring them here, and then are there other variables that determine whether or not they stay once they decide to settle down?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bailey, I think there's a lot of overlap between those two things. The interesting thing about migration in this group is, again, these people are very mobile, and if they don't like a place, then they move on. So, but we know also that the likelihood of moving declines by about half from your 25th to your 35th birthday. So it really is, you know, how sticky can your place be? And it really is the same set of attributes that attract people here and retain them. But we know as people become more rooted in place that in particular, schools becomes a bigger factor.
Thank you.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your remarks this morning. They're very interesting. I think you mentioned that there's a small increase in, I don't know if you were talking about the corporate tax or the business tax or the individual tax, that the negative impact of the tax is offset by the expenditure at the state level because that has a positive influence. But I think you prefaced that by saying it was a small increase. I'm just curious how we measure that the increase? Is it measured by relations to other states' taxes? Is it measured by where we are now and how far we move away from it? What's the measure of small? And then secondly, is there a lag between the taking of the tax and then the spending of it and the, we hope, benefit that is generated by that secondary expenditure?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bentz, the studies I'm talking about look at all 50 states and look at the variations in economic growth among states over time. And they construct essentially models, not unlike the kind of revenue model that, or the economic model that, Tom Pitowski puts together, and look at what the impact of tax levels are on economic growth and on public expenditures on economic growth. And what they tend to find is that there's a negative relationship between taxes and growth. That is, the higher your taxes, all other things being equal, the lower the level of growth. And there's a positive relationship between public expenditures and growth. So that those two, and the magnitudes of the coefficients of those two things, are just about offsetting. Neither of them is huge in explaining variations among states. Things like educational levels are very important. But the point is, the negative effect of taxes is, in the aggregate, tends to be offset by the positive effect of expenditures. So if you tax businesses or the population and threw the money away, the effect would clearly be negative. But the fact that you use the money to buy public services means that that offsets some, if not all, of the negative effect. But again, the effects are relatively small. And I apologize, I'm not sure I understood the second part of your question.
Yes, please. Yeah.
I was curious about the lag.
The lag.
But this, before we leave the first part of the question, I was really focusing on how much we can raise that tax on the business before the negative impact on the business is so great it actually isn't offset by the positive that is generated by the expenditure at the public sector.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Bentz, I'm not sure I know how. I mean, we'd have to have a very specific, you know, tax or proposal in front of us, I think, in order for me to be able to answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I guess my question is there any limit to it? Can we take all the money that's made by the business? Surely there's a top. So I'm just trying to get some general idea from you as to the amount you think is small, because I think you indicated that a small number, and I'm just trying to get there.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, again, every state tax system is basically in this band of about, you know, 10% of personal income plus or minus 1.5% or 2%. So if you started taking 15% of total personal income, but whatever set of taxes that you imposed, I think that would almost certainly have an effect. Now, you would spend it in some way, but in that band where most states are, I don't think it makes a huge difference. I don't think there's very strong evidence to show that it makes a huge difference.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Others? I had a question, and I have managed to forget it. but I would say this, that I really appreciate your coming this morning and giving us this brief overview of what the scientific data tells us about these things. It is very easy to get caught up in the discussion of positions on tax issues, and I've been around the legislature long enough now to know that you can predict the positions are going to be taken by a person based on the place they sit at the table, as it were. And it's useful to get some sense of what the actual economic data show us, and we appreciate it. Anything else, Representative Bailey?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Please, yeah.
I appreciate the testimony, and I think it would certainly be helpful for me, and I would presume to say helpful for this committee, I think, to if you have specific studies that you're able to share.
Oh, sure.
I would particularly be interested in economic valuation of quality of life variables that I think would be really useful for me to see, as well as any information that you have about propensity to relocate, the value of a firm that's relocated versus growing one here. Those sorts of distinctions would be, I think, extremely helpful to see.
I'd be happy to share the references that I have with the committee.
Fantastic. Thank you.
That would be wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We appreciate your willingness to come and share with us this morning.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Good luck.
All right. And with that, we'll close the information meeting and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2472. And are we starting with a new list today? We have a new list today. Is there anybody here who was on the list last time who did not sign up on the list this morning? These people were on the list last time. Okay. All right. Okay. Now, there were some people who approached me at the very end of the meeting last time who I wanted to take first, and I don't remember who they were. Are they here this morning? I don't see anybody moving. Okay. Well, let's just start with the people who were here last time, and then we'll pick up the ones who signed up new again today. Jeff Bissonnette, Daniel... I'm going to butcher this name. I apologize. Eisenbergs, perhaps?
Eisenbeiss.
Sorry. And Tom Gallagher. Tom, there's room at the table if you want to take... actually, there isn't, is there? We need another chair.
Mr. Chair, would you like to stand?
No, that's fine. We'll take you next. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, today representing the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition. We are a statewide collaboration of consumer groups, environmental organizations, human service agencies, faith groups, clean energy businesses, and labor groups, all focused on progressive energy policy, working over the last decade in the state. And I just wanted to come and briefly talk about the bill signed up in opposition, recognizing again that this was sort of a starting point placeholder bill, but representing particularly two members of the coalition that work a lot with the Business Energy Tax Credit, and that is the Northwest Energy Efficiency Council, which is the trade association for energy efficiency industry in the region, and also the Community Renewable Energy Association, which is a collaboration of primarily Eastern and Southern Oregon public bodies, businesses, and nonprofits that are working on small-scale renewable energy programs. So I just wanted to come and talk to you about the and underscore the diversity, some of which you heard last time, about the folks that utilize BETSI. And a lot of the attention goes to some of the large-scale wind projects and some of the manufacturers. But for folks like CREA, the Community Renewable Energy Association, they are developing much smaller-scale primarily wind, but also other kind of locally based renewable programs. And the BETSI is a key strategic tool that they use, and that is bringing economic benefits to eastern and southern parts of the state. In addition, again, we focus a lot on renewables, but the energy efficiency industry uses the BETSI a lot, and it's a very important tool in helping those businesses that range anywhere from very large companies such as Johnson Controls, Siemens, McKinstry, down to one-person consultancies. And so, again, I'm very happy to be a part of the discussion of the future of BETSI and where folks would like to go with it. But, you know, we are a voice that would say use a scalpel, not a meat axe, in making approaches to making changes. Thank you very much for the for the opportunity to testify and to be happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Daniel Eisenbeis, representing the League of Oregon Cities. As you can tell, I'm feeling a bit under the weather, so I'll try to keep my remarks brief. We wanted to, as an association of all 242 cities in Oregon, note our opposition to the cap that's envisioned by House Bill 2472, and that it's not a focused way to approach targeting Betsy dollars. It would keep well-deserving projects from accessing these funds. We also believe that it would create uncertainty in the market, which would hold back some of these projects from moving forward in the first place to attempt to secure Betsy credits. In the case of public sector projects like those owned by cities, we are dependent upon finding a willing pass-through partner that has a sufficient tax appetite to secure Betsy credits. Uncertainty about whether we would be able to receive final accreditation of projects would just make finding a pass-through partner that much more difficult. I've attached for you today information from the Department of Energy for all 104 city-owned projects that have been approved for Betsy credits since the beginning of 2006. You'll see that those projects, for the most part, are energy efficiency projects. Many of them are very small-scale. Awarded credits under $3,000. However, those projects all have a benefit for local residents and taxpayers, and the cities are becoming more efficient and reducing their operating costs by making use of Betsy funds to upgrade HVAC systems, to put in high-efficiency lighting, to improve efficiency at wastewater treatment plants. A number of cities also use the Betsy to invest in transit facilities, which reduces transportation costs for city residents and provides transportation options for Oregonians. With that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify and would be happy to address any questions.
Thank you, Tom.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Gallagher representing PGE, and to an extent in my second half of my remarks on Portland Business Alliance. Let me speak first just to the bill. We oppose a formula that comes first come, first serve on Betsy tax credits. We think that if you're going to do any kind of shaving of this, you need to develop a series of criteria. For example, when a utility uses a Betsy tax credit and they take the tax credit, that tax credit is actually calculated into the cost of the investment by the PUC, and the tax credit in that way passes indirectly through to the taxpayer. So the customers of PGE become the beneficiary of the taxpayer, not the corporation in that sense. So there are some criterias that we think that would make some sense here. The point that I want to make here is that you are coming close to a colliding public policies here. I understand your revenue issues very well, and tax credits are something that you're going to have to take a very hard look at. But the second element that is moving through this legislature and has been for the past two sessions is that of climate change and carbon reduction. The Betsy tax credits are one of the major tools used by businesses, individuals, and programs in terms of reducing carbon, especially for utilities and large industrial operations. They're going to have to make massive investments either in energy efficiency, in new transmission, in renewable energy, and so forth. The use of the Betsy tax credit is a distinct value, a direct value to the customers and therefore to your constituents. And at some point in time, each and every program that we have on carbon reduction touches and uses and encourages people to use the Betsy and the Retsy tax credit. So as you carve that back, you will be making a direct impact on the individual Oregonian and Oregon businesses' ability to deal with carbon.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I was particularly interested in the last few comments having to do with the suggested criteria, and I was hoping that you were going to get to some of those.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, I did suggest some.
Mm-hmm.
One is where does the ultimate result of the tax credit end up?
Mm-hmm.
The second is are the programs, you know, how directly related are they to actually to carbon reduction itself, as opposed to job incentives and other elements? The certainty of the tax credit, which Mr. Eisenbeid and others have talked about, when you have a first-come, first-served basis, it just doesn't work. Developing those criteria, whether it's by rule or by statute, and trying to meet just a capped number, that creates a serious planning problem for almost everybody who does long-range planning. And most of the large projects take years to develop. I think you heard that from the solar people and others. So I understand that you want to stop the revenue loss. I understand that you want to do that, and I think perhaps a Betsy tax credit is one that you might take up later in the session as we wait through and look at the whole package and look at the whole way that you deal with both the revenue side and, as we do the carbon bills, how we deal with the carbon bills.
Thank you. Does your company own any wind generation in Oregon?
Yes, we do, Mr. Chair. We'll have approximately 500 megawatts of wind energy with the complete build-out of Bigelow, and we are making new investments in purchasing of green tags and other renewables in the state and in the region.
And is that power end up being used in Oregon, or does it end up being sold out of state, or do you know?
I do know, Mr. Chair. The Bigelow power, the power that we generate here, will be used in state. When I talk about the credits sometimes, and that brings me to a more difficult problem, and that is, as you build wind energy out, you have to go to sites that are the best sites for the wind. Mm-hmm. They're often not on or close to a transmission line. So they are going to require investments in transmission. And then you get into the transmission grid lock problems we have inside of the system in the Northwest region right now. So in the future, it will make some sense not to wheel that power and try to move it back into Oregon as you use it, but to try to use it more close locally, where you don't have to use the transmission and stress the transmission system as much. So the concept of is it used in Oregon, is it used somewhere else, is an elusive concept. It seems fairly easy on its face, but the whole operation of the transmission system and the interrelationships of all the utilities in the Northwest make that a bit of a too easy an answer for where green power goes.
Thank you. Does that prompt any other questions? Thank you very much. Representative Betts?
Yes, I'm sorry. Forgive me. I wasn't quite clear on your statement about the tax credits interworking with the ratepayer. Can you go back to that for just a second? Explain that again.
Mr. Chair, Representative Betts, make sure I get this absolutely accurately correct here. When we use a tax credit, then we build a project with it, let's say. The project has to go back to the PUC, which makes a determination as to how much the ratepayer should pay for that project. And in making that calculation of how much of those costs are passed on to ratepayers, they take in effect the true cost of the project, which includes the tax credit. So the tax credit indirectly gets passed back through to the customer.
Follow up.
Yes, please. Yeah.
The idea then is that the ratepayer pays a lower rate as a result of the tax credit, or pays the same rate as though the tax credit hadn't been used.
Let me make it this way, if I can answer your question this way, Mr. Chair, Representative Betts. Let's say the facility cost $100, and there was a $10 tax credit. The ratepayer would be responsible for repaying $90 of that $100.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you very much. Bob Russell and John Charles.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm with the Oregon Trucking Associations. There's basically three ways that we can reduce emissions from diesel engines, including carbon, and reduce our carbon footprint. We can change the engine so it burns differently, and that way reduce our emissions. We've been working with the Environmental Protection Agency since 2004 to do just that. In 2004, we had a generation of diesel engine that dramatically reduced NOx. 2006, we went to low sulfur diesel in preparation for the 2007 engines, which have particulate traps and reduce particulates as well as some of the carbon gases. And then in 2010, we have a final generation of engine that again drops NOx dramatically. I'm told that when we have the 2010 engine, the exhaust from that those diesels will be cleaner than the air in downtown Portland. So we are well on the path of changing the way our engines burn petroleum-based fuels to reduce emissions, including carbon. And the second way that we can reduce our carbon footprint is to change the fuel type. In Portland, we are now required to use a blend of 5% biodiesel. Those of you that were here last year may recall that we also passed a bill that requires a 2% blend when we reach a certain production level and then a 5% blend of biodiesel statewide when we reach a higher production level. Our engine manufacturers today are working on blends up to 20%, and we're hopeful in the next few years that we will actually be able to use 20% biodiesel. So that's a major step in reducing emissions, including carbon. The third way that we can reduce our emissions is through conservation. The Betsy Tax Program is a very pivotal part of that. And what we do is we buy things that go on our trucks that make them more aerodynamic. For example, wind deflectors that are go on the top of the cab that blow the air over the top of the trailer, side skirts that go on the trailer, boat tails that go on the back of the trailer to stop the draft from the square back, low rolling resistance tires, and auxiliary power units. And auxiliary power units, there are a variety of types of them. Some of them are totally battery powered. Others have a small diesel engine, but no matter what type they are, they dramatically reduce the idling of the main truck engine. Again, we have the incentive of the Betsy tax credits to put these things on our vehicles. Of course, they have to save a minimum of 10% of diesel fuel. A fully outfitted truck today will get almost 9 miles to the gallon. That doesn't sound like much, but when you figure that a truck without all of those things on it gets between 6.5 and 7 miles to the gallon, 9 miles is a huge improvement and a dramatic reduction in fuel consumption and carbon output. So we would strongly, or one last point. I'm told that the state actually earns additional income tax revenues because of our use of the Betsy, because it drops our fuel cost, and it depends on the on how high diesel is. You may recall last year it was almost $5 a gallon. Today it's down to about $2.30. If our costs go down, our profits go up, and we're actually paying more income tax. So over the long term, and it takes about 2 years for a payback on when we install these kinds of appliances, so over the long run, the state actually makes money by encouraging us to reduce our consumption of diesel fuel with the Betsy tax credits. So I would hope that you would strongly consider maintaining the Betsy tax credits for our purposes.
I suspect you two are going to talk about very different topics, so why don't we ask for questions for Bob now, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley. I'm doing very well this morning, aren't I? Representative Riley.
That's fine, yeah. I know who I am.
Yeah, but I do it for the record, not for you. Thanks.
I was very interested in the last thing you said, which was that the state actually makes money from giving you the Betsy, and I wonder if you could expand on that. I didn't quite follow. I want some real numbers instead of generalities.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, there's a company that operates here in Oregon called Cascade Sierra Solutions. They basically started down in the Chairs District in Eugene, and it was part of the Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority, LRAPA. And Sharon Banks is the principal. And basically she has built a business out of putting these kinds of things on trucks. She's opened storefronts in Portland, and we have the first one was in Coburg, now opened in Sacramento, soon to open in Seattle and Medford. Her goal is to have a series of storefronts at truck stops from British Columbia all the way down to Mexico to clean the air on the entire West Coast corridor. I was talking to her last night, and basically what she said was what I just testified to, is that after a period of 2 years, the actual cost of the investment in the devices to reduce the fuel consumption is paid off. So then you actually realize real savings because of the reduction in fuel use. That increases profitability and it increases the income tax to the state. She actually has a spreadsheet that calculates that. She was doing it while I was talking to her on the phone. So it depends on a couple of variables. It depends on what things the trucker actually installs on the truck and how much you're reducing fuel consumption. And the second thing is it depends on the cost of fuel. Obviously, there's a much greater impact when diesel fuel is more expensive. I don't think anyone in this room expects diesel fuel to stay at $2.30 a gallon. I think we all expect it to get back to $4.75 to $5 a gallon relatively quickly. At those levels, I mean, it makes a significant difference in profitability.
Follow-up. I'm intrigued by this. I'm curious, then, why, if this pays back in 2 years and starts making money, why is it that you wouldn't do this even without the Betsy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley.
I was wondering the same thing.
A lot of the folks that Sharon is working with are owner-operators, independents kinds of folks. They don't have the cash up front. What she actually does is she uses the Betsy tax credits. She also uses low-cost loans. She got a chunk of money from the state's infrastructure bank that she actually can use for low-cost loans. It's the combination of things that actually makes it work for independent contractors and even some of the companies. In order to actually have the initial capital to make the investment to realize the savings.
One more follow-up, please. So a low-cost loan would work just as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, it depends on how low-cost it could work.
Okay.
It really has been the combination of things mm-hmm. that have made this program successful, and she has been very successful, and I would certainly recommend to the committee that you contact her and have her come. She's far greater expert than I am, if you would like that information.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute. I listened to all the testimony the other day, and I have sat through a number of briefings on Betsy, and I just have a couple or three observations about the program, generally knowing that this bill before you is a placeholder. One is that there's sort of three classes of problems with the approach of the Betsy and probably RETSI programs. One is that you frequently end up subsidizing projects that would or should be done anyway because they're big money makers. In fact, if you go on the website right. for Department of Energy and look at the feature page for Betsy, the success stories that they trot out, that they show and they give numbers for, are energy retrofits that have payback periods of roughly 4 years. And after that, they're substantial money makers for the company. So to my way of thinking, well, with a payback like that, why are we giving them money? That's something they should do anyway, or they would be doing. So you're just subsidizing the obvious. The other classification of problems at the other end of the spectrum, which is subsidies for projects that would never go forward without huge subsidies because the payback period is either over 50 years or it's infinity. There simply is no payback period. They're big losers. And this is mostly very capital-intensive solar and wind projects that happen to be taking a lot of the subsidies right now. I think it's safe to say that projects that have negative cash flow for infinity represent a business model that is not sustainable. Somebody somewhere has to make money to subsidize these. So if you have a program that encourages this, you're not creating wealth for the state. You're destroying wealth by diverting capital from other more productive projects. Moreover, because things like wind and solar are not baseload sources, they're boutique sources, they're not even contributing much to the grid. They're actually a negative for the grid. They require extra transmission, et cetera. So there's no particular reason that we should subsidize them. And if those are available, I mean, people for a decade have had, most electricity consumers at the retail level have had green power programs available through utilities like EWEB, PacifiCorp, PG&E. And in fact, we know empirically that only about 3% of ratepayers, when asked to pay a premium for the true cost of these, voluntarily opt in. Roughly 97% of ratepayers in Oregon are completely uninterested in doing this. So why are we making them silent partners in these projects that they knowingly don't want to participate in? Third is the subsidies that are basically irrelevant. Let's just say the subsidy to a hybrid car. I mean, it's just a car. It's the premium to buy it without a subsidy would almost never be paid off in gas savings. And if better fuel economy is all you're interested in, you can find dozens of cars, especially the newer diesel vehicles that get phenomenal gas mileage. They're not hybrids. And the life cycle environmental footprint of a diesel or of a hybrid, especially depending on how the battery is disposed of, may be a negative. So it's just there. It's a product. It's not worth doing anything about. The market should just sort that out. So I think rather than tinkering with Betsy the way is anticipated in the bill in front of you, or any of many iterations of tinkering, I think you should look at a solution that was discussed actually yesterday very eloquently in a different context by entrepreneurs who came before you and said, gee, you know, when we have the lowest production tax rates in the entire country for our industry, it really encourages investment, wealth creation, job creation, and when things go wrong, it's our private money that goes down the drain because we're not subsidized. And that's the benefit of just lowering or eliminating entirely business taxes. You get out of the business of having to pick winners and losers, which you can never do properly. And for every set of complex rules you set up to try and pick winners and losers, for every action, there's a reaction. And we know certainly one of the ugliest cases was with the California re-regulation of electricity in the late 90s that invited Enron and a lot of other companies to sit and look at it and say, gee, we can print money here. And it just blew up because they game the system. People will always game the system. So I encourage you to think about lowering, flattening, simplifying the system, the taxes, and then make this, send the signal to global capital markets that Oregon is a great place to invest money. Let private entrepreneurs and venture capitalists assess which of these technologies makes the most sense, which investments make the most sense, and let them bear all the risks and the reward. You'll get all the revenue back that you want by job creation and the income taxes that you collect from workers without having to pick winners and losers. So I think that's a general path to consider besides what's in the bill. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? I don't see any. Thank you. It's a very explicit and clear statement, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Let's see. Sandra Bishop and Alan, both from Community Energy Systems.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us to address the committee this morning. For the record, my name is Sandra Bishop. I'm a former Eugene Water and Electric Board Commissioner. I served on the EWEB board for 10 years, from 1997 through 2006. Today, I'm here representing Community Energy Systems, but I want to talk a little bit broader than that as well. Since leaving the EWEB board, in addition to government relations, which I've done for a very long time in the Capitol at the state level, I've also been working as a renewable energy consultant. And in that capacity, I engage with regulatory, permitting issues, and as well as coordinating assessments such as carbon and greenhouse gas analysis. I'm here today to talk about the importance of the BETSI to locally based renewable energy projects, and I urge you not to set a cap on the BETSI. Oregon is a leader in renewable energy use and is becoming a leader in development of the plants. The world is becoming increasingly focused on reducing the use of fossil fuels. The states and regions that are able to diversify the sources of energy will benefit both environmentally and economically. There needs to be full state support for the continued adoption of both traditional and innovative fuel sources and projects that reduce this reliance on fossil fuels. And I want to just put a little footnote in here. And I know that Representative Riley was asking for specific examples. If the BETSI is incapacitated or limited, you will drive away not only the new innovative type projects, you will also prevent the building of traditional projects in Oregon. And an example I'm going to use is that I'm a consultant on a project in Eugene, Oregon, which has a nameplate capacity of 18.8 megawatts. This is a biomass cogen, high-efficiency cogen, for a very traditional sawmill. That plant is going to cost out at $45 million, create 11 or so permanent family wage jobs, in addition, 90 construction-related jobs. 11 million of that 45 million is going into pollution control equipment. This company is putting on double the required pollution control to keep particulates and other things out of the air. This is a reduction in greenhouse gases. This project would not have happened without the aid of the BETSI. And it's just a one example. So states that are able to utilize existing high-efficiency technology as well as emerging technologies will become leaders in the industry, and I think that's what Oregon's trying to do in studying the manufacturers here as well. And it will also, of course, prevent the damage to the environment. CO2 emissions account for the majority of greenhouse gas. Some will tell you that it's as much as 87% of the emissions are CO2. We must do all we can to reduce that CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions. Carbon counting is going to be not a fad diet for Oregon, but the measurement of a healthy state. If you limit the BETSI, Oregon will end up with a new product for export. We are going to be exporting our projects, our renewable projects. We are going to be exporting our innovation. Innovation is touted by the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department as an advantage that Oregon has that distinguishes our state from other states in the realm of economic development with coupled with environmental protection. You will give that up if you don't continue the Betsy. So I would just ask that you please support the Oregon Department of Energy. They do an excellent job in administering the program. They do not put out Betsy credits for things that are undeserving. I have gone through the process. They're very thorough. They're very professional. Please trust them. The state's doing the right thing. Please continue with that. And I'd like to, with that, I'd like to introduce Alan Branscombe, who's one of the principals with Community Energy Systems. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for this opportunity. As Sandra said, my name is Alan Branscombe. I'm part of a company called Community Energy Systems. We are developers of renewable and alternative energy projects across a range of scales, from an individual schoolhouse to large facilities that will have all-in costs above $400 million. We have offices in Oregon and in Colorado, and as a consequence of working in multiple western states, we have had a chance to see firsthand what the difference is in the feasibility of bringing projects into existence with states that don't have the program, as in contrast to Oregon, the only one who does. And I can tell you that the difference is stark. As I'm sure you know, and forgive the pedantry here, but from our point of view as project developers, we are not manufacturers of equipment. The Betsy floats both. We have one very precise window into what project development is, and it concerns the conceived two-stage project development phase. The main construction phase, where all the money is spent, certainly dominates the financing. But the capacity to actually get the investors to invest and the lenders to lend depends crucially on a pre-construction phase in which the uncertainties are dealt with, permitting, design technology risk assessment, that is, design engineering, the securing on a contract basis of the inputs and guaranteeing the sale of the outputs. All of that must be in place before the investors will invest or the lenders will lend. This may only be 5% or 3% of the overall project cost, but there is a kind of Pareto rule that is at play here, in which that initial 5% may well consume 95% of your effort, and in very many cases thwarts these projects altogether. Bringing up energy projects is a ferociously difficult enterprise in any case, and in most cases they don't succeed. The Betsy makes a crucial lift in getting over this berm. It's not that there is only two polar alternatives here, one in which the economics are so great that the Betsy isn't needed, and the other in which the economics are so poor there's no sense to it. There is a third pathway here that, at least in our particular case, we confront regularly, and it's the one that I've just described. How do you get over that step when what's on the other side is a perfectly conventional and well-established process not involving the necessity to pull something out of the sky or invent new technology? It's just the same old stuff being done in a slightly different way. I'd like to just focus on, in closing here, on one particular dimension of this. As you may have seen in the Oregonian Sunday article about, in the first in a series on solar power, increase in production capacity is driving the cost down dramatically. Only a few years ago, it was $20 a watt. It's passed through six recently, on its way to one. $1 a watt, you might have been able to get a coal plant up for that 10 years ago. The kinds of projects that we're seeing are in the $2 to $4 range. So when solar is brought down to the point where it can actually stand on its own, the Betsy has contributed to, it's not the only factor here by any means, but it has contributed to a circumstance in which once its work is done, the training wheels can come off and these facilities can stand on their own. Secondly, from the point of view of that risk phase problem that I mentioned earlier, solar in particular has a specific benefit to deliver. because solar power is so reliable, the sun comes up, it is generated, the sun goes down, it stops. How much a particular solar facility at any latitude and based on its meteorological conditions can produce is well known. So a power purchase agreement can be achieved, can be signed, and that certainty of production entrains the entire process of financing and construction into place. Because that's there and because the Betsy is available, a pathway in carefully selected circumstances exists in which the Betsy, monetized for the solar project, can be lent to another clean energy project to get it over its risk phase work. That larger project then repays to the solar project at its several multiples that loan, in effect then, in consequence, giving the solar Betsy project funds access to the very much more robust income stream and tax stream from it that the larger project can produce. This particular follow-on benefit of the Betsy is not one that I have heard previously described. So it seems to me that as the plummeting cost of the Betsy, the solar cells shows, the Betsy has a kind of utility in the early stages, which was part of its original intent. In our particular case here in Oregon, if the Betsy were to be significantly curtailed, it would thwart about 12 megawatts worth of solar projects that we and our partners are now trying to bring up. And all told, for community energy systems, it would bring into very serious doubt just under $1 billion worth of capital projects. So thank you very much, and that's the end of my comments.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I would like a little bit more of a description of the point you were making about a small project allowing a large project to go forward. Could you be a little more concrete about that so that the slow-brained chairman today can understand it a little better?
I think the slow brain is on this side of the microphone, Mr. Chair. As I'm sure you know, it was described earlier this morning, the Betsy, of course, can be sold at a very substantial discount that is easily monetized. Those funds can be lent to a closely coupled larger energy project to deal with its risk phase questions. That is, in a fatal flaw search, you take the highest risk question first and conserve those monies should any difficulties be discovered in this process. Once those funds are expended and the requirements for the capitalization of the construction of the larger project are in place, then that project recognizes a carried interest back to the solar project to not only repay the face value of the Betsy lent to it, but also at multiples that constitute an income stream for the long term to the solar project.
Thank you. That's helpful. Anything else? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony and especially for coming on what I'm sure is a busy day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Doug Riggs and Jody Weiser. Why don't you go ahead?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Fuel Cell Alliance and also as the co-chair of the Northwest Energy Summit, which is an annual conference in Portland, which has over 24 sponsors and has gathered over 500 people in the last 2 years to Portland to talk about renewable energy manufacturing, emerging technology, utility issues, et cetera. I want to make three short points. I know we're late in the day. First point is from an economic development standpoint, Betsy equals three things: new jobs, expanded jobs, or maintained jobs. The taxes, or these jobs, equal tax revenues for the state, which can be used for a myriad of programs, including education, human services, and public safety. In the case of many of our sponsors and participants in the conference, we've heard directly from them about the importance of Betsy. We had a panel last year, and several economic development experts from these companies come and testify, and they mentioned that there were jobs that would have been located in places like Utah, California, or Idaho, were it not for the small incentives provided by BETC. So specifically because of BETC, we have created jobs and maintained jobs. In the case of the fuel cell industry, BETC is one of the very few incentives that the state has to incentivize new manufacturing of fuel cells in Oregon. We have three companies, one in Beaverton, one in Hillsboro, and one in Bend, all of which have grown dramatically. All of those companies have been tried to be enticed to relocate in other states, and at this point they have decided to stay and expand in Oregon. BETC is a key factor. The second point is directly related, and I would urge the committee to think of BETC not as a revenue loser because you're providing a 50% tax credit, but I would argue that 50% of something, which is 50% of the income that's generated by these projects, is better than 100% of nothing. And in the case of many of these smaller companies, when there are better incentives in other states, they might be tempted to locate elsewhere. So again, it is an incentive to keep, expand, and maintain jobs in Oregon. And the last point I'd make is related to the point that Bob Russell made earlier, but I'd like to add a little more specificity to it. In tough economic times, if we're trying to incentivize companies, industries, organizations to reduce carbon emissions, when the economy is going gangbusters and people have high profit margins and lots of employees and we're not laying off people, it's much easier for a company to make a decision to invest in clean technologies. When the economy is difficult and profit margins have fallen and you're laying off employees, it becomes more and more difficult for a company, an individual, a business, or a resident to make a decision to go with a solar plant, to go with a fuel cell backup system for a truck, to put a fuel cell into a cell phone tower, et cetera. There just isn't the discretionary ability from a financial standpoint to be able to make those decisions. And so in tough economic times, at a time when the state is trying to reduce carbon emissions, BETC may be that one factor that will continue us on that pace to reducing carbon emissions. Without BETC, many of those companies which are struggling will not make those investments at all. So I appreciate the opportunity, and we certainly support BETC. It's been a key factor in the job growth that we've seen in our industries, and I would urge your continued support for the program. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Riggs?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank
you.
Thank you, sir. Since this has been characterized as a placeholder bill, I hope you'll afford me just a tiny bit of latitude. On the emerging technologies front, one of the things that I'm interested in with regards to the BETC is that it seems to me there are kinds of two classes of projects out there. There are projects that are less risky and I think possibly have better access, better capacity to get the BETC, and then those projects that are potentially more risky might actually, in the long run, benefit Oregon more because we're spurring emerging technologies, but those companies might have a harder time getting the BETC. And I think a primary example here is that, you know, looking at the development of wind technology over the last couple decades, we might have reached a point now where wind is no longer an emerging technology. Wind might not even necessarily need the BETC as much, but actually probably has an easier time seeking out these funds. And then, say, a fledgling solar company that's trying to work on next-generation technology or the fuel cell industry or the wave technology industry, right? These companies that are out there really trying to push the envelope mightn't actually be able to get access to these things. And since you're representing an emerging technologies front, and since this is a placeholder bill, I'm wondering if we can delve maybe into those policy implications and whether or not we should be looking at adjusting the BETC in this way to change the kind of dynamic of who's in line and accessing what resources.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Call, good question, excellent question. I certainly understand the difficulties facing the committee and the legislature as a whole with overall tax revenues. I guess what I would argue is that both the guaranteed larger type of projects that we're talking about, wind and solar, which have been very successful and clearly created jobs, and some of the smaller emerging technologies. I mean, fuel cells are a great example. Idatech, for instance, in Bend has 89 employees. So we're not, the size of a solar world or some of the larger wind installations that have been taking place. Those 89 jobs in Bend are fairly important, though. And we've taken really relatively limited advantage of the BETSI tax credit. So I guess what I'd say is that at this point in time, when we're looking to get to the technology for 2025, and it doesn't currently exist at market prices for us to be 2025 compliant. And part of the goal of BETSI is to be able to incentivize some of those technologies that may not be on the upward side of profitability. As expansion expands or manufacturing expands, the margins increase and the cost per unit decrease, and then we get over that hump. And in fuel cells, that's in particular what we've been looking at, growing the manufacturing base for fuel cells to a point where it's economically viable is absolutely key. And one of the incentives to get us up over that hump, and I think that's what you're referring to, is this type of a program. You know, 10 additional systems, 20 additional systems, 30 additional systems for a small company makes a huge difference. So I hope that's been helpful.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
And I guess my question, just to move a little more deeply, is kind of a philosophical question about the BETSI. It seems to be, as you said, serving two functions in this regard, right? Those helping those companies that are already profitable, you know, maybe make our marketplace a bit more attractive, but also helping companies like yours over the hump towards moving their technology on its own towards profitability. And I'm wondering if you would chime in about if, in fact, we're going to be looking at restructuring or curtailing or doing anything to the BETSI, on which side of that do you think the benefit long-term to Oregon's economy is best realized, in subsidizing businesses that might potentially come online as profitable immediately, or helping those maybe riskier and honestly, I mean, just to be very clear, on that side of things, you know, we're hazarding less of a risk with taxpayer dollars, right? And on the other side of it, potentially, while we might be hazarding a larger risk, we might actually be putting Oregon on a better footing in the long run. So I'm not ideologically in favor of it either way. I don't necessarily know that I have an opinion on this, but I would love to hear yours and whether or not you feel like the system as it exists is appropriate, or whether you think we should be hazarding more of a risk because the upside on it would be a greater reward. That's my question.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cole, I think, a very good question. I guess I'd look at it a little bit differently. I would say that I am leery of the government deciding which of those two approaches to take, because I don't think government is usually very good at picking winners and losers in technology. What I might say is that we could work with the Department of Energy to make sure that
you're getting smiles behind you.
That's good. What I might say is that we might work with the department over time to make sure that we have a more clear understanding of the fact that are we getting new jobs, expanded jobs, or jobs that are being maintained in the state. And I think what you'll find, and I think Director Graney testified to this last week, is that there's some pretty good evidence about the fact that we've created overall jobs, and that in the communities where those jobs have taken place, there is an economic factor downstream with, you know, people going into Target, people going into Home Depot and purchasing materials and equipment that keeps the rest of the economy going. So I'd rather not look at it as which industry am I going to pick. Am I going to pick an emerging technology or one that's a little more established? Because I'd like the market to decide that. I'd like to provide the same incentive for folks who have a good idea. What I would say is that let's make sure that the money we're putting into it is creating jobs for Oregon, which generates tax revenues, which goes into the types of things that I talked about earlier.
Thanks.
And I'd be happy to talk to you more offline as well.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Riggs? Jody.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon, an all-volunteer citizens group. For a couple of years now, we've had questions about the BETSI, not because, as the graph shows, it's had enormous growth. And the numbers on the graph are really, the blue is what you expected from the when you were passing laws. The orange is what, the tax expenditure report said to expect. The orange is what you thought you were passing in 2007 and 2008. And the green in the middle bar is what's actually happened. What happens if the green in the next biennium, you know, happens? What if there's the same kind of expansion? And that is an issue. What do we do? Because we're spending a lot of money on BETSI. But that isn't really the big issue. The big issue is whether we're spending the money in ways that we need to be investing money. And we are investing taxpayers' money. In some projects, we're investing 30% of the cost of the project, 50% of the cost of the project. That's a lot of money to put into something that the public has no ownership of. So I think the idea of an annual cap doesn't make a lot of sense, but I think we should look at other ways to really limit what's happening. There's one wind farm developer that wants to locate a wind farm in Harney County, but he's calling it four wind farms. So he'll get $44 million rather than $11 million for that project. That's constraining that sectionalizing the business up into four businesses is something that Mr. Graney said he's having trouble doing something about. So I think that it makes sense for us to really look at whether that's what we intended when we passed the law. A grocery store has many different purchasers, and they don't say we're many different stores, but wind farms are tending to say, well, the power from these windmills are entering the grid at this point, so that's a wind farm, and besides, that's being sold to Southern California Edison. This set of turbines is producing energy that's entering the grid at this point, and we're selling it to Eugene. This set of turbines is creating energy at this point, and we're selling it to Glendale, California. So those are three different projects. We get $33 million, not $11 million. That ability needs to be constrained, or we'll see projects that are advertised. There's one now being advertised as the world's biggest wind farm, but I'll be really surprised if they only ask for $11 million for that wind farm. They'll probably ask for 8, 9, or 10 Betsy's for that wind farm. And is that really what you intend to be doing? Or do you want to draw the lines around these projects more carefully so that you're limiting what you're giving to a mostly foreign company for very few long-term jobs? I was talking to one wind developer, and I was told that their wind farm, which is about a 100-megawatt wind farm, typical Oregon size, that's where you get the $11 million most easily. And I was told by that project developer that the wind farm was providing 25 jobs. The website for the same firm says the wind farm is providing 14 jobs. And industry analysis about how many employees, long-term employees, it would take for that size project says that it's someplace between 6 and 8 jobs. Well, even for 25 jobs, $11 million is a lot of money. But if it's really 6 or 8, we're talking about paying $2.2 million for a job in Harney County. I don't think that makes sense. We could take the $44 million and put every student graduating in Harney County to college full ride. We could invest the $44 million and just use the revenue off that $44 million to subsidize all those kids to go to college. And they wouldn't have to pay any of their costs. That might be a better investment, and I think we need to really watch and see if what we're doing makes good sense. I think there's really no longer any evidence that wind farms need this kind of subsidy. There's been articles in the Wall Street Journal and in the New York Times where basically they're talking about a different kind of subsidy, what they're getting for their green tags, if they're selling green tags, and they've said the federal production tax credit is what we need. So we're probably investing money in wind farms that we should be investing in other technologies instead of in that place. And I don't think we've established a place where we're going to see businesses come and say to us, you don't need to do this anymore. We're self-sufficient here. We just heard a few minutes ago that the solar costs have gone from 20 to 6. But there was no statement that said, and when it gets to 3, we won't need Betsy anymore. But I think that there's that kind of thing we have a responsibility in this building to make those kind of decisions about. Wind was being built in Oregon when it was being sold for $50 to $60, and now it's being sold for $80 to $90. Don't we think the profit margin has developed to get the businesses to come? Some people will say, well, it's because of Betsy that wind farms have come to Oregon. It's true that the wind companies are taking the Betsy. It is not true that it's caused our development to expand. If you look at the bottom of the second page that I gave you, I looked at the material from the Northwest Renewables. I'm trying to find my package. Their website looks like this, and they have a list of all the energy projects in the Northwest. If you look at the projects that were completed and running on December 31st of 2008, Oregon had 32% of those projects. Now, some of those projects did get the $11 million Betsy, but they were already running before we expanded the Betsy, or they wouldn't have been built by the end of 2008. Since then, if you look at the projects that are in the process of being developed, they're either being built, they're in permitting, that they're online to come online if they can get their financing, our share has dropped to 27%. You can see at the bottom of the page, we had 1,035 megawatts of power. Now we have 3,306 megawatts of power. That's about a threefold increase. But look at Montana. They've had a 17-fold increase, and they don't have a subsidy at all like the Betsy. They're not giving away money like we are. Or look at Wyoming. They've had a 7 times increase. They don't have a Betsy for wind. Idaho's had a 17 times increase. They don't have a Betsy for wind. What's causing the explosion of wind throughout the West is all three states very notably created renewable portfolio standards. And because of the renewable portfolio standards, our energy suppliers have to give us clean energy. Wind is the current cheapest source of clean energy, so they will buy clean energy. And that necessity to meet that standard is driving the building of energy. The next thing that is, where does it locate? Well, it locates where there's wind resource. It locates where there's transmission lines. And those are the key things that will decide it. Betsy's not choosing. It's going to happen. It may encourage companies to come here 5 years sooner than they would, but once all the land that's got good wind resources used up, they'll start building solar. And it really won't matter what the price of solar is. They'll have to use solar as long as we stick by our renewable portfolio standards, which is the driver, and which I believe you've heard people testify is what, you know, California's 33% is what is making the price go up. And on top of that, at least $80 million of the Betsy's that we've so far committed ourselves to is for wind that's being sold in California. While it is true that a Betsy given to PGE or PacifiCorp for a project that's going to deliver its power to Oregon will reduce our ratepayers' fees. But most of our wind is not being sold to Oregon ratepayers. And much of it's not even being sold where the price is regulated. It's sold to California where that's an unregulated market. So we're not really even reducing the cost for the people in California necessarily. What we're doing is increasing the profit for companies. And I think that that's not our responsibility as a legislature. So I think the biggest thing you could do is really question whether we should be supporting wind at all. The second thing I think you should look at is whether we only want to do tax credits. Because what's happening is with many projects, the public is basically paying for the price of the project, but they're ending up with no ownership. An example is the array of solar cells that are at the interchange at 205 and I-5. The Oregon taxpayer Let's pretend that's a $100 project so it's easier to talk about. The Oregon taxpayers paid $50 for that project. The federal taxpayers paid $30 for that project. And when the project is depreciated, based on whether it's accelerated depreciation or bonus depreciation, the taxpayers of Oregon and the U.S. will provide another 12 to 34% of that project's cost. Well, that's pretty much the whole thing. Yet, we're not getting any rent for the land it's on, and our cost savings is whatever the power is actually worth. So PGE has got a nice deal. It's a good deal for business. It's a lousy deal for us. When we paid someone to build the interchange itself, we paid them to build it, and then the public owned it. And we don't have, somebody else doesn't own it. Well, we're paying for those solar panels as taxpayers of Oregon and the federal government. But we're not owning it once it's paid for. And that doesn't make sense. It's partly because we've chosen the model of using tax credits rather than the model of saying this is how we're spending money this year to do these projects. But we could even put it out over time by bonding the money and saying to the transportation department, we want 20 of these projects along our freeways. This is a great idea. But here's the bonding. Go pay a company to build it and then let us own what we have paid to build. It's how we built the freeways, and it is how we should be building some of these smaller projects where we're really, as taxpayers, out of one pocket or the other, paying for most of the cost. And it is driving costs down. It is creating innovation. But there's no reason why we shouldn't have ownership when we're paying for something. There are a couple of other more minor things in the Betsy law. When the Betsy was capped at $3.5 million, if a project ran over its expected cost, we paid $350,000. But when the Betsy is capped at $10 million for many projects and $20 million for manufacturing, that 10% cost overrun is costing us $1 or $2 million on most projects. And most of them, if you look at the wind farms, they're all getting $11 million. They're not getting $10 million. The manufacturers will get $22 million. They'll not get $20 million. Well, are you aware that we're allowing a cost overrun like that? Because if any state agency has a cost overrun, they don't get to just say, oh, yeah, give me another 10%. Yet we're doing this with private industry in our private-public partnership, and it doesn't make a lot of sense, and I think we could just wipe that out easily. We could consider reducing the 50% to a smaller percentage, back to 35 on some of our projects. But for sure, the 10% doesn't really... there's no particular sense to it. It's just something that was in the law. And finally, there's a place in the law that we fiddled with in 2007 that I cannot understand, and I have not had a lawyer be able to read it and say, oh, yeah, this is exactly what it means. Not sure how it's being used, but basically where it raises the question is, if we're now subsidizing a solar project at 50%, and the federal government is now subsidizing it at 30%. What happens if the federal government changes their percentage? What if the federal government, not paying attention to Oregon's 50 cents, says we're going to subsidize at 60%? Because we've got a lot of states that aren't doing what they need to do about solar energy, so let's up this. Well, then, is Oregon still going to give 50% if the federal government is giving 60%? I think we really need to know which way that goes, because obviously in the president's speech tonight and in the action that happens over the next 2 years, we want to know whether we're actually going to be making just the construction of a facility profitable without it ever being operational at all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Jody? I would like to simply add that I think you raised some excellent points and some important issues. When we heard from Mr. Graney earlier, it was clear that the vast bulk of the dollars that we spent last year on these tax credits really went to these very large wind projects. And I think it is clear that we need to explore whether that's a good use of Oregon's tax money or not. I have specifically asked for information on the issue of the benefit to Oregon of subsidizing wind projects where the power is sold out of state. The testimony we heard last time was that establishing a limitation that would require the power be sold in Oregon was a bug. I'm beginning to think it might be a feature. I don't know what my personal conclusion is yet about that issue, but if we are to make a change, it might be that the change we want to make has something to do with the limitation on the huge subsidies we're giving to wind generation where the power is sold out of state. And I'm saying that out loud here today because I would appreciate comments on that idea from all and sundry as we go forward. Jody, I really appreciate your testimony and your clear thinking about these issues. Thank you very much.
I wanted to say one thing in response to that. I think that there is some question about whether we have the right, because of interstate commerce laws, mm-hmm. to limit whether we would subsidize a project going out of state. And it might be a much simpler way to do it, would just to limit our exposure there, would be to say we're going to subsidize it at $50,000 per job. And that would bring the cost to set wind farms down dramatically. And it isn't also a decent measure. You know, we need some measure. We asked in 2008 that there be some criteria written around the job production. And really, there weren't any criteria written. So we might want to come up with a number that, you know, just because you've added to your facility doesn't mean you've added a significant number of jobs.
Yes.
And so that would be a simple way to do it, is to say, well, here's the limit per long-term, full-time, verified job that pays a certain level and has certain benefits.
Thank you. That's that would be another suggestion for us to look at. And, of course, we did put limitations on in that area and in several other areas on subsidies to manufacturing plants, but we did not do it on subsidies to generating equipment like wind generators and solar devices. And that is another area that I think we'll be looking at as part of the exploration we make this session. Thank you very much. And we have two more people who wanted to be heard today, Desiree Strader and Eric Peterson. Sorry, please come forward.
Craig Campbell.
Oh, Craig, did you want to be heard too?
And
Ralph Groner as well. We've got too many people coming up, so let's have the two that I named first, and then there are three people who had their hands up. Why don't you be on deck, and we'll try to get you in before 10 o'clock. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. For some of you, this may be a little redundant because you heard me testify last week. But a couple quick numbers. You know, my name is Desiree Strader. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. And a third of the BETC that was granted in 2007-2008, solar was only representative of less than a third of the BETC, yet over two-thirds of the jobs. We are looking on deck with 5 to 6 new manufacturers coming here in the next 12 months. We are estimating in the next 2 years a job growth of 3,500 jobs in manufacturing in solar, and not just PV. I think the story on Sunday was very limiting just to PV, but also, as you know, this is a very big, expansive technology with thin film and many other technologies that represent the solar industry. With that said, the Betsy has been a very useful economic development tool.
Right, and you don't need to swallow the mic. It'll actually work better if you if you back up just a little bit.
Thank you. Yeah. Sorry. I usually don't get that, Chair.
Thank you.
I'm usually too short to reach the mic.
Well.
So I got a little excited, sorry. So with that said, now you lost my train of
thought. I'm sorry.
God.
I apologize.
It's awful. I think it was a prior president that said it's about the economy, stupid. I would say it's about the job, stupid. We are in deep competition. Massachusetts just recently launched a funding mechanism to recruit, not in the form of a Betsy, but more of a loan, bridge loan, and type of financial tools. We had one company that we are recruiting here in Thin Film who recently was down visiting in Nevada and said clearly that they could not compete with the recruitment tools that Oregon has in place. We had another Thin Film company just visit from Germany who had been on a national tour. All arrows point to Oregon for being by far the most progressive in solar development, R&D, and job creation. So as you guys go forth this session, I would seriously caution you on the impacts of capping the Betsy in solar in particular. And with that said, I think the industry also knows there needs to be some fixes. I think a lot of what Jody Weiser just said, there's a lot of truth to several of her points. And we would like to work with the committee and the legislature to ensure that the tools that are being given to us, especially during these tough economic times, that we treat them with the respect that they deserve and that they are going to job creation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to speak. It was an interesting drive over from Bend this morning.
Welcome to the Valley.
Thank you. I'm here really because I believe deeply in the opportunity that renewable energy means for economic development in this state. I believe in...
And for the record, would you identify yourself?
Sorry.
Thank
Eric
you.
Peterson. I'm the Vice President of Sales and Marketing for PV Powered.
Thank
located
you.
In Bend. I'm here to tell you that the Betsy is working and that my company, PV Powered, is a great example of the benefits of the Betsy to the state. I strongly oppose a cap on the Betsy program for solar, and I'll keep my comments to just solar. PV Power was started in Bend in 2003. I joined the company in the fall of 2006. We had 18 employees. With the help of a R&D Betsy, which funded the development of our commercial product line, we entered that market in 2007. Since then, we've grown the company twofold in revenue, and we now have more than 50 employees. Those are high-paying engineering, manufacturing, marketing, and sales jobs located in Bend. We've assembled a strong team and created a compelling business plan. We're in the process of retrofitting a 100,000-square-foot facility, which was a former wood products company in Bend. And with that facility, we will be able to enter the worldwide market for commercial solar. And on an expected 30 to 40% annual growth rate, we expect the company to be well over 100 million and 200 employees in the next 3 to 4 years. I'll leave you with two final thoughts. As I've traveled around the country over the last 2 years, meeting with solar developers, financiers, project planners, what I've continued to hear in the last year is that Oregon is a leader in clean energy. All of those people are either opening offices, finding opportunities to site projects here, and are excited about the leadership that Oregon has brought to the renewable energy across the country. One final thought. We're in the process of raising a strategic round of capital for our company that will finance the next phase of our growth. What we've heard from all of the investors is that the Betsy program and the focus that Oregon has on renewable energy is incredibly appealing. Any of those investors could move us out of the state, but on all of those visits, they've said that they want to keep us here. And in fact, the last company that was visiting with us just a week ago actually has a footprint already in renewable. They have jobs located in another state based solely on the Betsy program and the support that the state has given to PV Powered and solar in general. Their plan would be to move all of those jobs to Bend into the facility that we're expanding. So I really want to say the Betsy program has worked for us. It's working for solar. I think it's bringing good jobs to the state of Oregon, and I urge you not to cap the program for solar.
Thank you, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, I have heard many times we have high-paying, good-paying jobs. Can you give me, if you have it off the top of your head, about what your company average is for jobs?
I can't give you an average. I can tell you that our senior engineering positions pay over $100,000 a year. Mid-level engineering positions would be in the 70 to 85, and our manufacturing jobs start at around $16 an hour. And you can assume that the marketing positions, mid-level managements, are in the 60 to 70 as well.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Other questions? I have one. And I probably should know the answer to this, but I don't. What is a solar inverter?
It's a great question. Thank you for the question.
I'm a psychologist, not an engineer.
The modules that you guys hear a lot about, and that are those companies that are locating typically over here in the valley, those modules create electricity from sunlight. That is DC electricity. The grid is AC. The inverters connect to the grid and allow that solar system to be grid connected as opposed to battery backed up, and converts the DC electricity to AC for use by the residents or business and for sale back to the grid.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, there were three who had their hands up. Why don't you three come forward?
Just
and
every day?
Well, I have an inverter in my car.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I apologize. I had put my name on the same line as Mr. Gallagher to come up as a panel. I'm going to learn in the future to put it on a separate line so I can make sure that I'm seen.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, there were two names on that line. Yes.
I'm actually here on behalf of Pacific Core to urge the continuation of the Betsy tax credit without imposing annual limits. I'll keep my comments brief. Pacific Core has participated in the Betsy program both through its direct investment and qualifying projects, and I'll give an example, which happens to be a wind example here in a moment, and also as a pass-through partner to help Oregon businesses, nonprofits, and, in fact, government entities to take advantage of the program. It's been a real incentive to us to promote economic growth in Oregon through the jobs that have been created through the projects we've participated in, and we've been able to couple those with applicable federal tax credits, which induces us to it reduces the cost for us to build in the state of Oregon, which for us is important. The one example that I can provide you with is that we use the Betsy tax credit as an incentive for us to develop the Leaning Juniper wind facility, which is a 100-megawatt wind facility out of Arlington, Oregon. The energy generated from that facility is used in Oregon and is part of our renewable portfolio standard collection of energy that we will be using for our required renewable portfolio percentage. Together, the Betsy and further develop. I'm just going to go off my notes and talk straight. It's a lot easier than going off of the notes I had before me. When an organization like Pacific Core is making its determination as to where it's going to invest its dollars for developing renewable portfolio energy sources, the Betsy has and will continue to provide it with an incentive to build and develop those resources in Oregon. As you know, the renewable portfolio standard allows companies like Pacific Core that can draw their energy from six different states to incentivize its locating those facilities here in Oregon, generating jobs in Oregon. And as a result, we encourage you to continue the Betsy credit as it is. We understand that there may be some tweaks and changes that you're going to want to make to that, and we look forward to working with the committee as you move forward on this bill, but wanted to get on the record in support of Betsy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner with AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I attended our state conference Friday night, and my members are worried, worse than I've ever seen them. So I'll only say the top priorities to our union are our employees are already making their kind of contribution, state employees, to you. But we also look at efficiencies and tax expenditures that Jody Weiser talked to. They truly need to be looked to what they deliver. However, where we come from more than anything is we desperately need new revenue, but then the final point, I'll be working in front of you on new revenue on almost every issue, jobs. So let me say to you that I call it the work that Representative Tobias Reed, who sits on this committee, has worked on so hard for the last few years, is probably a gold mine in front of legislators, and I find both Republicans and Democrats like the plan. I worked with Michael Graney for the last several years. It started with my own home by making it energy efficient, and I found I reduced my heat bill by 50%. As a novice, I said, why don't I go and work on this? I did. I called over 100 local governments, cities, counties, etc. I should say to you that Ask Me is not so much a state employee. However, if you look at your own cities and counties, and I look at all of you, if they are union in Oregon, Ask Me is over 90% of the public, be they service districts, cities, and counties. So what I want to give you and publicize is it's currently an LC, and some of you are already co-sponsors of both parties on this committee. It's exciting, and that is, I call it the Oregon Public Building Energy Efficiency Initiative, since I can't get a better name out of anyone. The fact is we'll provide thousands of jobs, and if you ask me what the salary is, the electrical workers, IBEW, are sitting in the office. These are the kind of people that will go to work. What they will be doing to all public buildings, and not just state, city, county, special district, will be to make them energy efficient through a combination of funds. We're lucky. This is hot. We're just getting federal dollars for energy efficiencies. But Betsy is also one of the little tools that my cities, counties, special districts, and the state need to match maybe other working funds, loads, et cetera. I can tell you that this program would reduce a trillion BTUs of annual electricity and natural gas and energy use of 9,000 homes, additional tax revenues in the millions to the general fund, and 100,000 tons of carbon, the footprint reduction. By the way, I'll kind of close on this because I'm excited about this program. You wonder why a union like mine works on a program like this. One, this union works on creation of jobs, and it creates income tax that comes in, but I also represent the environmental state agencies such as DEQ, Metro, etc. So we also are very involved in the world of energy. I would close with this. The other night I accidentally stayed here when there was free grapes and cheese out, and I'm usually there. I'm talking to a gentleman about my excitement about the Oregon public building because I found that it's bipartisan. And I said, my God, it saves the taxpayer money. And it can be shown that it saves the taxpayer significant money and energy costs. And he said, talk to me. And I kept talking to him. He said, here's my card. And he was the vice president of Solar World in Hillsboro. And then he introduced me to all these people, and I became frightened. He said, I'm going to widen with this. He said, are you aware what this would do nationally? The same thought process. If we go nationally, you're talking millions of new employees going to work. But he told me a little story. I won't go into that, except in Michigan, he said, we have a plant that delivers product to Hillsboro for our plant, where they're unemployed and auto working. This would fill the factories with employees nationally because solar would be a part of the energy. They're just one part of. So I want you to know, Oregon should be the lead in this, and if we're first, our Congressman, Schrader, et cetera, I've already been everybody's ear, but hopefully you will. It's currently an LC draft. It's coming in front of you, and some of the sponsors are sitting up here. We'd like you to be co-sponsors and realize the amount of jobs, the amount of income coming from those jobs, the amount of carbon reduction, and the amount of energy reduction also helps the grid grow with all your dreams of alternative energy, because you can only put under the current grid so much energy without it breaking down. So this is, in fact, a savior temporarily to helping the grid get to where the trillions we need to fix it nationally. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have one more witness who would like to be heard today.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, committee members. My name is Marion Haynes. I'm with the Oregon Business Association. I'll try to be very, very brief. There's really two goals that we see as underlying the Betsy credit: economic development and sustainability. We don't believe that those are mutually exclusive goals. As we're moving into a carbon-constrained environment, investments in energy and fuel efficiency are going to be really critical for keeping businesses productive and competitive. The tax credit has been important in positioning Oregon as a renewable energy leader. We think that with the priorities of the new federal administration, that we really have an opportunity to continue that leading role, and the Betsy is an important part of that. The environment will become more competitive, and that's why we think that the Betsy is a tool that we need to have in place, again, with the national policies heading in that direction. Also, when I talk to economic development professionals working, there are still significant opportunities in renewable energy. As we're seeing other industries contract right now in this economic environment, we have real potential still in that arena. Finally, as we heard, Massachusetts is looking at programs that can stimulate this kind of activity. Other states are looking at these kinds of programs, I think, largely because of the success that we've seen here with the Betsy. And again, that will increase the competitive environment that Oregon is operating in to bring these kinds of jobs here to the state. So we'd like to see the program continued. We don't think a hard cap is the way to go. In particular, we don't think priority given to the date in which applications are received are the way to go. That being said, this is a tough revenue environment, and it's absolutely appropriate that we take a hard look at it right now and hone the tool and really target it to make sure that we're doing the best we can do with those investments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony this morning. And is there anyone else who would like to be heard today? We have two more minutes. We've reached the end of our list and the end of our time. Thank you very much. The public hearing is closed. And the committee is adjourned. Sorry, did you want to?